a celebration of the talents of Willie Rushton, who died last year. The programme is hosted by Ned Sherrin.
When Margaret Thatcher told her cabinet that everybody ought to have a Willie, she was referring to Willie Whitelaw. But Willie Rushton was even more essential, perhaps, to the gaiety of nations. And I'm here with four friends at the Coach and Horses, one of Willie's haunts in his private eye days, for what we'll call a Willie wake, if only to satisfy the apt alliteration's artful appeal. The four friends are Barry Cryer, Richard Ingrams, Lance Percival and Tim Rice. First of all, first meetings. I first met him at the Room at the Top, Ilford, where he was appearing in Cabaret with Barbara Windsor and John Wells. And there was a heavy sort of craze.
And me.
Well, you were there. I'd totally forgotten your performance. That's probably why you didn't join the main team of that was the week.
It could well be.
However, tell us about your first meeting.
Well, it was some years before, in, I should think, 1950, when we were both new boys at Shrewsbury School. And Willie was in exactly the same house as me. He was a day older than me. So we were, if you like, exact contemporaries. I never thought Willie changed throughout his life. He always seemed to be exactly the same person, as far as I was concerned. I mean, he grew a beard later on, but he was the same.
So he would have been, what, 11 or 12 when you met him?
Yes, but he seemed to be very grown up, even at that stage. He seemed to have sort of found the answers to life in some strange way that I hadn't.
And didn't want to be promoted in the army like you?
No, neither of us made it into the officer ranks and class, I should say. I never understood quite how Willie failed to get a commission. He failed to get to university, first of all. He tried to take O-level maths, I think, six times, and failed. And then they put him on, they said, well, why don't you do biology? So he did biology, and he went into the exam, and there was something in a test tube, and they said to him, what is this? And Willie put down, disgusting. And he walked out. That was the end of it. But he did something like that in the army, too, so he never made it to
Lance, you met him in, what, 62?
I met him in 62 at the first rehearsal for the pilot, for that was the week that was, I think it would have been in Lime Grove. And my abiding memory is rather similar to Richard's in the sense that the last time I saw Willie was in October 96. And sartorially, I don't think he changed at all. He was wearing pretty well the same outfit. Obviously, he bought another one, but, you know, the dress was exactly the same.
Will and I had a great contention about when we first met, and we couldn't remember. And Willie always said it was somewhere around the back of David Frost. I always remember that. It was in the Frosty era, and we couldn't remember for the life of us. And he said, that's what old friends are about, he said. We don't remember.
You pick up a vivid memory. You're much younger, of course.
Well, that's the trouble. I'm so much younger. And when I first met Willie, he was already a big star, and he had been one for 10, 12 years. And I can't remember. I've been racking my brains, but it must have been at a Lord's Taverner's dinner. And I think for the rest of my life, I still looked upon him as somebody who was a big star. I mean, he was, of course, a big star, but I was always strangely, slightly in awe of him. I mean, I was enormously fond of him, but he was just so good at talking.
That would have worried him terribly that somebody was
I didn't tell him. I tried not to tell him.
People were in awe of him, and this used to upset him, I found.
Well, he was just so...
He didn't like it.
But he's very, very sharp and witty and funny. Yeah. And it's very hard not to be impressed.
Yeah.
Let's hear the abiding memory from TW3, which was his impersonation of Prime Minister Macmillan in a short sketch.
Hello? Hello? Oh, is that the White House? Oh, Jack? Oh, it's Harold here. Harold Macmillan. M-A-C...
And he did of course the farewell. I remember singing "The Party's Over" as Harold Macmillan, very sweetly and very touchingly in a little spotlight when the old boy went, which of course led to his election involvement.
Yes, well, actually, one of Willie's great disappointments was the fact that Macmillan resigned because he lost a very good part because of that.
And the next, and you got Alec Douglas.
I got Alec Douglas, which I could never do anyway. But he was marvellous at doing. I mean, I think he had his revenge by going out immediately and contesting the election against Douglas Hume.
My favourite memory of Willie from rehearsals of DW3 was he rifled through Frosty's briefcase on one occasion and he came up with a file. He found a file which had been labelled Airport Quips. David had become an international traveller and expected to be interviewed at every airport where he touched down. I always remember also when we would we were doing a song called Fat Men Are Coming Back, and it was going to be Willie and Roy Kinnear, and we thought we'd get Fred Emney in to be the third one, and looked at Willie and Roy Kinnear and decided neither of them were remotely fat.
He was quite portly on television back in the 60s. He seemed to me that. But also, he seemed very much part of this incredibly daring new outlook on politics. I mean, I was one of the people deeply affected by this wave of satire as a schoolboy.
So it was
quite sort of shocking. I mean, I remember teachers saying, well, it's all so terribly destructive. This sort of thing won't last. But of course, it did, and it changed attitudes to politics ever since.
Used to be letters and telegraphs saying, can't we have constructive satire?
Absolutely.
Willie and I had this from our respective mothers, I think. When are you going to get a proper job? They couldn't believe that it was going to last. But he was a very good writer of lyrics, Willie.
Yes. Well, we're going to hear one. We're going to hear one which actually has its origin in those. It's an early Private Eye LP. I think it must be. The song, because you used to bring out those LPs, what, Christmas?
Well, they weren't proper LPs. They were little sort of flexible things that were
EPs
stuck on the,
or flexible discs.
They were stuck on the front of the cover of Private Eye.
But they play, because you will now hear Neasden the Song.
I've been as far as Orpington, Tuffnell Park and Golders Green, seen the northern lights of Arlesden and visited East Sheen. I've travelled out to Ongar on the dear old Central Line. I even went to Ruislip in 1949. I've been far south as Tooting Beck, where sheep may safely graze. And I sometimes think it's hard to say where I'd like to end my days. But then I shout, oh Arthur, what a Burke you are. There's a little place you love just off the North Circular. They call it Neasden. You won't be sorry that you're breezed in. The perfect lights and yellow lines, the illuminated signs, all say welcome to the borough that everybody's pleased in. Neasden. Oh, where the birds sing in the trees, done. You can hear the blackbirds coo, so why not take the Bakerloo? It'll work out that much cheaper if you buy a Neasden. Neasden. Oh, where the lissos are deep trees, done. Oh, where there's bingo and boutiques, and the wimpies last for weeks, and very tasty too, with a slice of cheese, the Neasden. You could want a better reason. Ah, you will not fail the thrill when you hear a Dollis Hill, that the next stop on the line is the place that I call mine. Is it Sodom or Gomorrah? No, it's God's own borough, Neasden. Bloody Neasden, you twit.
There's that wonderful riding roughshod over the rhymes, isn't there? Sort of having fun with this, like E.Y. Harburg almost.
This is what obviously inspired Tim to go on to Joseph and His Amazing.
Who wrote the tune?
Who wrote
the tune to that?
I think I did, actually.
Oh, did you?
I'm sorry to own up to
it.
Have you been sued?
He was a great lyricist.
Brilliant.
A yellowed fax. I read this, as Richard might remember, I read this at his funeral. Rushton, the lyricist, I could never sing this. He wanted to do this with me as a duet at Edinburgh. But I said, no, you do it, because it was wonderful. St. Vitus's dance. What was the dance St. Vitus danced that did so gratify the Lord that they beatified him for his terpsichore? Play me a chord. And I will dance the dance that Vitus did, that caused the cardinals in Rome to say that dancing halls should have, and they would suffer no complaint, a patron saint, and then went home. They searched through history for a holy man who danced, and then they chanced upon a man whose wild gavotte would frustrate all the devil's tricks, and though they were as tight as ticks, they said that when this Vitus kicks, he does a lot of good for Gott. And then they danced the dance that Vitus danced. The world was shaken to the hilt when in a bowler hat and kilt, Vitus quadrilled. They searched through history for a holy man who danced, and then they chanced upon a man whose hectic lurch would give Beelzebub the creeps. And while the whole of mankind sleeps, it's guaranteed when Vitus leaps, it's bound to liven up the church. And so they danced the dance that Vitus danced, and when the saints come dancing in, frequently sequined, he's a dream. He is the mainstay of their own formation team. They stand supreme. They always win. Oh, invite us, St. Vitus, to the dance.
Yes,
Willie Rushton.
Oh, I can see why Willie was going to do it on his own.
Richard,
I was no fool.
Barry's complimented him as a lyricist, but I think you probably feel that his greatest achievement, which we can't really illustrate on radio, was the cartooning skills. Wasn't it?
Yeah, and he did that from the earliest days that I remember. I mean, when he was at school, he seemed to be a fully fledged cartoonist. I don't know where he got it from. He had no ancestral cartoonist or anyone. All the time he doodled on any piece of paper. He did these sort of mustachioed men in bowler hats. And these funny feet he had, they were all sort of, someone said they were like wheel clamps. He said he couldn't do feet. And then later on, he did all the drawings of the early Private Eye, mostly political. And then he invented a sort of entirely new type of cartoon, which was a sort of Rabelaisian type of cartoon, of hither Gloria, I'll take a shilling's worth. And there was one that you would particularly appeal to you, I think, Ned. These two elderly gays in bed together in the street, and there's a policeman comes up to them and says, adults you are, consenting you may well be, but I would question the privacy of Lounge Square.
So, but he'd gone, you had gone the routine way through the army to university. He'd gone into a lawyer's office.
Into a solicitor's office. And then, I was reminded of this by Andrew Osmond, he had an accident. He was nearly run over by a bus. And
brave bus.
And he decided then that he was never going to do anything that he didn't enjoy in future life. And he then immediately gave up being a solicitor and took to freelance cartooning. And all he could get was a job on the Liberal News.
But how much was he a part of the forging process?
He and Booker, between them, did pretty well all the very early issues of Private Eye, and they were done in Willie's bedroom, 28 Scarsdale Villas. There was something called Letraset that had just been invented, and he did all the headlines, and he did all the drawings.
It's a sort of website for the 50s, wasn't it?
And there was Cowgum, too. We had Letraset and Cowgum. A very important parts of the proceedings.
Much later in the 80s, when he was diagnosed with diabetes, he seemed to me to lose none of the élan, none of the fun that he used to have when he was drinking.
I think he was quite grateful in a way, actually, that he'd been feeling very ill, and when the doctor said, finally said to him, you're a diabetic, you'll have to give it up, I think he was quite relieved. He told me that he'd done a lot more work as a result of that. He got quite grumpy, I think, but I liked that. Yeah. In the last years of his life, I mean, his drawings certainly was, he did a fantastic amount of drawing.
And then the books he did as well.
Books.
He wrote with great, a huge sort of vaulting imagination.
Indeed. And very, very beautiful colour.
You said grumpy, but he always managed to carry it off. People would always yell and say, hey, Will, and all that sort of thing. But he managed to carry that sort of thing off with great good humour.
Yes. I mean, my memory is always saying, you bastard.
they would love that, wouldn't
that
they?
Was his greeting.
He would always insult you to your face, and you'd find out he was saying nice things behind your back.
That's
always.
He appeared at one of the oldie literary lunches which you just started. And he got up, and he said, where would we be without a sense of humour? Germany. It was a brilliant opening. Everybody fell about. It was quite unexpected. It was such a good joke.
Well, we ought to think about Willie the actor or Willie the acting personality. I suppose School of Robert Morley, Wilfred Hyde White. He was in Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines and all sorts of... But we've just got one little snippet reading Eeyore Has a Birthday from Jack and Orrin.
Look at all the presents I've had, said Eeyore. Pooh looked first to the right, then to the left. Where? Can't you see them? No, said Pooh. Neither can I, said Eeyore. Joke, he explained. Ha, ha.
I think we can say it was personality actor rather than a careful delineator of a variety of characters.
Yeah, the heir apparent to, as you said, Robert Morley and Wilfred Hyde White and people like that.
He loved all those people. I mean, we used to go and see all those films when we were schoolboys.
Yes, he did. He did flying machines with Morley, and Morley wanted to go off after lunch one day. He had his big scene starting the race or something, and he wanted to go to Ascot. No, write it in, Rushkin to do it, you know. So Willie was happy to stay there for days on end afterwards.
Willie loved the theatre.
Yes.
He loved going through a stage door and everything.
Never came late.
But I remember in the musical of Gulliver, which Willie, I've forgotten what he was playing now, but he was playing King of somewhere, and once or twice things would not go quite as well as he'd expected. I mean, he'd probably get the lines right, but then he'd say, hang on, take two, and do it again. True to the words, but he actually did them twice, which is not what the author intended.
The value of his voice and character comes across in another form, which is the fact that one of the most used voices in commercials has been Willie, and that went on for years, right to the end.
Yeah. Yeah. You knew that he was no nonsense, because Willie had that feeling, the stamp of truth.
I always thought he was always intact. Whatever show he did, he was Willie.
And he was able to rise above... sometimes perhaps not the most intellectual of material. One thinks of the odd panel game, but he always brought the panel game up rather than sunk to that level. But when was the moment he changed from being William to Willie? Because I'm sure when I first heard of him, he was billed as
William on TW3, but we always called him Willie.
But later he was billed as Willie. It was like, you know, the nation just couldn't cope with him being William.
I called him Will, and he said, oh, I like that, suddenly one day. And I was taken completely by surprise. I like that. He used to be called Will.
Somebody mentioned panel games. So one of the most idiosyncratic, chaired by dear old Johnners, and with two taverners here, we ought to hear a little bit of trivia test match.
Which 30s musical star went on to become Mrs. Dale in Mrs. Dale's Diary?
Jesse Matthews.
Right.
That was a beautiful... beautiful half volley outside the off-stump, wasn't it? Very easy.
I didn't think it was easy, Brian. I just thought I played it skillfully.
As you did Jesse Matthews.
Don't waste time.
Over my shoulder goes. Oh, sorry. We'll have a quiet single now to get a bit of excitement.
What was Norman Bates' hobby in Hitchcock's Psycho?
Stuffing birds.
You're right. You get a single?
Another single, yes, please.
How many humps do the camels native to Central Asia have? The ones native to Central Asia.
It can only be one or two. Two.
You're right, two. Another single, an easy one there.
More camel questions. We'll have a crack another, a four, I think.
Right. In the Bible, what was Noah's wife called?
Mrs. Noah.
No, she wasn't.
Ah, they weren't married.
They were.
Some terrible revelations are coming out of this murder.
How's that? Sharon.
Now, wait a second. You've got it wrong, too. So both sides have got it wrong. The answer was Noah's wife or thy wife. She's never referred to by name. Oh. How many more balls is over? Two to go?
It's just a one for us now. We're giving up for it.
What is the average United Kingdom female bust size?
A swift titter ran through the audience.
We've moved down from Lords to the Oval, I know. Yes.
And the last word there from Robin Bailey. How did that all start? Was it? Were you always the same team?
I was one skipper and Willie was the other, and Johnners was the umpire.
Oh, you
in
had
charge.
Guests? Did
you? Yeah, and we each had one guest on our team. And we began the series doing it from the Paris Theatre. And it worked okay, but it didn't really take off until after about the third year we went round the country and we went live to cricket matches. And having Willie and Johnners there, it was always a huge event for the local club. And it got better and better. And like all these shows, people don't notice it's on until it's been running for about 5 years. And after year five, people were saying, that new show you're doing with Willie Rushton is terrific. And then it's now been off the air, tragically, for 4 or 5 years. And people are still saying, you know, I really enjoyed that recent broadcast. But Willie, thing about him on that show was he had an incredible knowledge. Obviously, he had the great general knowledge of kings and history and politics and everything. But he was totally up to date with trivial knowledge. I mean, he would probably now be able to name all the Spice Girls. Absolutely no problem. He somehow seemed to know everything that was going on in all popular culture, and very funny about it as well.
I'm just thinking about whether anybody else had cricket memories.
I'd like to actually just read something which is very, very typical of Willie, which he wrote. A year or so ago, I was put up for the Lord's Taverners, and Barry Cry, here on my left, actually proposed me. And Willie Rushton wrote this as a seconder.
I have known the applicant for 30 years and second the application, etc. Ideally suited for the tavern as being a total cad and bounder. He has clearly supped Cryer, five or so, used once as supped, I thought was a very willy word, for which Cryer is anybody's me in the five. But the fact that he's rode with Glub Pasha and can handle a camel does in no way atone for the acute embarrassment he has caused much by our own larger wildlife. It's a lot of willy in there.
Did you get in?
Yes, I did.
If I go back to the cartoons, that one has just occurred to me, which is one of his men sitting in the cistern of the lavatory, and another man underneath saying, "Oh, Jessop, will you never learn?" He was very good at thinking up names, too, really. There was a man very early on called Hugo Pramat, who was an artist of some kind with a beard. Other names like Vole Trouser. There was a mule damp. Another of his.
We're nearly into, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue time, I think, so let's let Humphrey Littleton set it up.
Now, our first round is called Channel 4 Children's Hour. In this round, teams, I'd like you please to suggest some titles of racy children's programmes suitable for a well-known minority channel faced with privatisation. Barry, will you start, please?
Chitty Chitty Gang Bang. ...101 Reservoir Dalmatians. directed by Quentin Dandiambino.
Louisa May Alcott's Big Women.
Winnie the... Was that you?
Snow White and the 9½ Dwarves.
Bill and Ben behaving badly.
And God created Noddy.
Postman Pat always rings twice.
Lord Baden-Powell's famous book, Snorting for Boys.
Jack and Orgy.
Last Tango in Trumpton.
Swallows and Amorous Nuns.
Okay.
Lust William.
Barry, I mean, how much have we given any guidelines before that? Because they are wonderfully extemporary things.
Well, that was typically of him. Yeah. The last one got an enormous laugh. He was the epitome of laid back. And we were all working our socks off, doing our puns and jokes. And Will would always come in with one. He struck like a snake. Suddenly, he would do something, and you thought, where did that come from? It was just him. It was from over there.
There's a great generosity on that programme, it seems to me. Everybody, there appears to be no comedian's competitive thing. Everybody seems to be enjoying everybody else's jokes.
I'll tell you a story. We were always on Radio 4, and are. They were repeated on Radio 2. And a few weeks ago, as we speak, Will and I both spoke at the same moment, as you tend to do on a programme like that. And Willie immediately held back and said, "After you, Bazza, you'd probably die first." And I love him for that. It was a wonderfully funny line. So,
right, that takes us through to Bazza's double act with Willie, the two old farts.
Never a double act. Two single acts. When I walked off the stage, he walked on, vice versa. And it was 7 years, and it was so happy. Working with him was an absolute joy. I would either be in the dressing room listening to him on the tannoy or standing on the side waiting to go on. And he made me laugh every night we ever worked together.
Oh, now. Hang on. Mr. Cryer, I would like to address the nation. As this is a lunchtime programme well before the watershed, we have had expressions of alarm from the local watch committee and several Liberal Democrats about the words
in the following songs. So we have a device here to excise any questionable
words. Get on with it. The next
words.
Act is tremendous.
Oh, right, right. There's, right.
There's women over there I'd dip into capital for. Hello, girls. Sorry, anyway.
I could have... and still have begged for more. I could have spread my and done a thousand I'd never done before. I'll never know what made it so exciting. Why all at once my took flight. I only when she began to with me, I could have
thank you, Jim.
All night.
Wonderful harmonies there.
Nearly.
We need the abiding memories. Lance, what's your
opinion? Well, no, I've actually wanted to borrow one here because I read something which, of all people, was said by David Frost. Do you remember him? He actually gave a very good line, I thought, when Willie just departed, which was quoted in the newspapers, and I read the next day, and I just thought it was a very good summary, which simply said, the older he got, the funnier he got. And I thought that was very good.
Yes, and accurate too, Tim.
I was a member and treasurer. Some very good advice he gave me at a Lord's Taverner's dinner after I'd spilt some red wine on my snazzy new white evening jacket. He said, I always dress to match the colour of the food.
A quote by Will about himself. In the opening of our show, we always did the jokes about being older. And he used to say, I'm often being asked what I want on my gravestone. I had a flash in Tesco's the other day. And I would go, what? And he said, I was wheeling my trolley round and I saw on a shelf the very word I want on my gravestone. It said, discontinued. And when Will left us, I was in a pub in Cambridge and I lifted my glass and I said, cheers, Will, discontinued.
Yeah, the nicest thing I think almost that I heard was the story that Dorgan, his splendid wife, said. She and Toby, I think, were there at the in the house when he was going in for the pre-med, and he phoned them and they chatted. The last thing they heard was that sort of and Willie had gone under, and they'd been talking until he went to sleep, which was enchanting. Richard, you have the first memory.
Well, I have the first memory, and my memories of Willie being unchanged throughout our long acquaintance. I think he was a very, and this emerged from so many letters that came into Private Eye, he was greatly loved by not just the people who knew him like us, but everyone else as well who'd seen him on the telly and heard him on the radio. And the part of the reason was, I think, that he was a very good person. And one of the very good things about him was, I think, that he lacked ambition. He enjoyed, he only wanted to do what he enjoyed doing. And I don't think he wanted to do anything else or be anyone else. And that was partly why he was so loved.
Willie, you're to start. I'd like you to accompany Frankie Lane singing Rawhide.
Rolling, 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 rolling. It's quite easy so far.
Rawhide.
Oh, that's quite fun.
Rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen, keep them dogies rolling, rawhide, through rain and wind and weather, hell bent for leather, wishing my girl was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good victuals, loving, kissing, awaiting at the end of my ride. Move 'em on, head 'em up, head 'em up, move 'em on, head 'em up, rawhide, crack, let 'em out, ride 'em in, let 'em out, cut 'em out, ride 'em in, rawhide.
In Willie's Wake, Ned Sheeran was reminiscing with Richard Ingrams, Barry Cryer, Sir Tim Rice and Lance Percival. The production team were Helen Williams, David Scott and Jonathan James Moore.